We're very pleased to continue our study in the first book of Samuel. We're now in the 10th chapter, ready to begin at the 3rd verse. The setting for this passage is that Samuel has just informed Saul that he is going to be the king. And in order to verify the fact that this prophecy about him being king is true, and to verify the fact that he truly is a man of God, Samuel has told Saul that he would have 3 signs on his way back home. He'd have 3 signs that would occur to him to prove this. The first sign was that he would meet 2 men at Rachel's tomb, and they would tell him that the ashes he'd been looking for had been found and that his father was concerned about him. And we read about that sign coming to pass in the 2nd verse of this 10th chapter, which we covered in the last lesson. Now, beginning in the 3rd verse, we have the second sign. Then shalt thou go on forward from thence, and thou shalt come to the plain of Tabor, and there shall meet thee 3 men going up to God to Bethel, one carrying 3 kids, another carrying 3 loaves of bread, and another carrying a bottle of wine. So here he's going to meet 3 men going up to Bethel, and he tells him where he's going to meet these 3 men, at the plain of Tabor, and these 3 men are going there to worship. They're carrying the items with them that they would need to use in their worship. So we learn here that this place called Bethel was still considered to be the house of God, as the name implies, because they were going there to worship. And it may still be that Jacob's altar was still there, which we read of in Genesis 28, verse 19. But they were going now to offer sacrifice. The 3 kids were for sacrifice. The 3 loaves of bread to be offered probably as a thank offering, and the bottle or skin full of wine for a libation. When the blood was poured out before the Lord, they feasted on the flesh and on the bread, and then they probably had enough wine left that they could drink it along with their feast. Verse 4 says, "And they will salute thee." Now, this salutation means that they're going to inquire of thee concerning your welfare, your peace. And this salutation, when it was given in the East, meant that it was friends greeting friends. And if the other side returned the salutation, then it implies that there was definitely friendship on both sides. So they'd have this salutation given to Saul. And then they will give thee 2 loaves of bread, which thou shalt receive of their hands. So when these events came to pass, it would be a definite fulfillment of the sign that Samuel said would happen. And of course, this sign then was another proof that these things were the doings of God. Now in verse 5, we have the telling of the next sign. "After that, thou shalt come to the hill of God, where is the garrison of the Philistines." Now there is no definite knowledge as to exactly where this hill of God was or what it was. Some think it was the hill where the ark of God was now located. Others have gone so far as to say that this was a place that had a school for prophets located on it, but we don't have any evidence that really shows that. But he was going to come to this place known as the Hill of God, where is a garrison of the Philistines. Now, the Philistines still had some stronghold here. Either they were allowed to have this by Samuel in their last defeat, or they had gained it back since their last defeat. But at any rate, there was a garrison of Philistines, and they didn't seem to be disturbing the people that much, but they were just stationed here for whatever purposes they may have wanted to have been here, and it was at or about this place called the Hill of God. "And it shall come to pass, when thou art come thither to the city, that thou shalt meet a company of prophets coming down from the high place." Now this company of prophets may have been prophets. Some say that they were men who had been trained at this school or who were teaching at this school for prophets, and that's the connection. Others say that the interpretation really means that they were scribes of the prophets and not true prophets themselves. But they were called here in the King James a company of prophets, and whether they were true prophets or whether they were the scribes for Samuel, it's a little hard to say. There are some who feel that Samuel was the only prophet in the nation at this time, and that may very well have been. But they're coming down from this high place, and they have some musical instruments with them, with a psaltery. And this word for psaltery is nebel, and as the word signifies in other places, it means a bottle or flagon, and it was probably something like the bagpipe. They also have a tabret. That's from the word tof. It's a sort of drum or cymbal. And then a pipe. That's from shalil, or from shal, and that means to make a hole or opening, and it would be a sort of pipe, flute, clarinet, or the like. And then they have a harp, kinnor, a stringed instrument similar to our harp, or that on the model of which a harp was formed. And then the last part of verse 5 says, and they shall prophesy. So here we're going to meet with these men who are described as prophets, and they're going to prophesy. They're going to give a message from God that is miraculously given to them, a message that maybe has never been given before, and it's going to be given here to Saul. But notice verse 6, and the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and shall be turned into another man. So here in this third sign, even Saul himself is going to be involved. He's going to be given the Spirit of the Lord to come upon him. He's going to be turned into another man, and he's going to prophesy himself along with these other prophets. So this would be a very outstanding sign. This would be something that should be the most convincing thing of all, that he then would be allowed to have the Spirit of God come upon him and to prophesy and to be turned into another man. We do not know the full connotation of what it would mean for him to be turned into another man, but it has to mean that there'd be some kind of a change in the man Saul simply as a result of him having received the Spirit of God. And of course we know that it is God's Spirit which changes our mind, which changes our heart today, that also makes us another man when we obey the gospel. Verse 7, and let it be, when these signs are come unto thee, that thou do as occasion serve thee, for God is with thee. Now after you've had these signs, Samuel says, after you receive the Spirit of God, then you do whatever seems to be the necessary thing to do. Do that as occasion serve thee. Whatever you have to do to carry out your office, whatever is necessary for you to fulfill your duties and your responsibilities, then do that. For God is with thee. God's going to help you to be successful. He's going to help to bring it to pass for you. And thou shalt go down before me to Gilgal. Now this is verse 8. And so he's giving Saul further instruction. Go down before me to Gilgal. Gilgal is one of the three places that Samuel went to on his circuit of being a judge. And so before he went to Gilgal the next time, Saul was to go down before him, before Samuel got there. And behold, I will come down unto thee to offer burnt offerings and to sacrifice sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days shalt thou tarry till I come to thee and show thee what thou shalt do. So he gives Saul specific instruction. You're to go to Gilgal, wait there for me 7 days, wait till I come, then I will come and show thee what thou shalt do. So Saul is not really left on his own here. He is being guided every step of the way by God through Samuel, and Samuel is telling him what to do. Now if he will simply obey the things that are told him to do, then he's going to be in the direct divine guidance of God. So his next step is to go to Gilgal and wait 7 days for Samuel to come. Verse 9, and so it was that when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, God gave him another heart. And all those signs came to pass that day. Now this ninth verse is just a summary of what did happen. And then we're going to go on in the tenth verse and have more detail about this third sign. But all the signs came to pass that day. God gave him another heart. Here was a man who'd gone out looking for some lost asses. He had a concern about the farm, about reaping and sowing, about taking care of the everyday affairs of the life in the country. Now he has another heart. He's going to be concerned with fighting the Philistines, concerned with matters of state, with settling the grievances of Israel, with being a king, with how to reign and rule in a just and proper way. He's not going to have time to think about lost asses anymore. He's going to have his mind and his total body completely consumed in the affairs of Israel, in the affairs of state. So certainly he has another heart. And this is the way it is when a person goes from a sinner to a Christian state. God gives another heart. We have things that are on our mind, things that we're concerned about, things that we are working for and about that we never even thought of before. We have an entirely new scope, a new outlook on life. There are things we're involved in now that we didn't even know existed when we had the old heart. And so it's going to be with Saul and his becoming king of this nation of Israel. Now verse 10 picks up about this third sign and gives more details about it. And when they had come thither to the hill, it's called the hill of God in the earlier part of the chapter, behold, a company of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. So this is simply retelling what did happen when he met these prophets, how that he had the Spirit of God, and he did prophesy among them. Verse 11, and it came to pass, when all that knew him before time saw that, behold, he prophesied among the prophets, then the people said one to another, what is this that is come unto the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets? So this became a publicly known thing. He was seen to do this. He was seen to prophesy with those prophets. And so the people began to ask the question, well, what's happened to this man who's the son of Kish? Well, he's just a farmer's son. And now here he is among the prophets. Is he also among the prophets? Is this a part of his activity, a part of his routine that we haven't known anything about up to now? What's happened here to this man? Evidently, in time past, Saul had nothing to do with these prophets. He might have even spoken about them in a light manner, but certainly he didn't join in the activities of the prophets. These were a group that were separate and apart from anything that he would do, and now here he is among the prophets and prophesying with them. So verse 12, one of the same place answered and said, but who is their father? Now, there's a little confusion as to what this question means, but it very likely means he's asking, who is the father of the prophets? Who gives them their power? Who gives them their authority? And the answer would have to be God. Of course, they're working under the direction of God. God is their father. God is their head. So when they ask that question, who is their father? Therefore, it became a proverb. Is Saul also among the prophets? That is, when you want to represent something that had drastically changed, you could refer to the fact that, well, Saul is among the prophets. Look at the changes come over him. Look how different he is. Look how different his activities, his behavior is now. He's listed as among the prophets. And so this was a proverb among the people that anything is possible if you don't believe it. Saul, he's among the prophets now. So look what a difference has happened to him. And we can see how that this being seen in public, being seen to have undergone a great change in public, helps to prepare the people for the fact that this man, this common man, this farmer's son, is going to be made the king for the first time in Israel. And he'd have to be accepted as king. But here's the first step toward the people accepting him in a capacity other than just being the son of Kish. Verse 13, and when he had made an end of prophesying, he came to the high place. So evidently after Saul had finished prophesying with those prophets, he went on to the high place there, no doubt, to continue to praise and to give thanks to God for the fact that he was going to be exalted into this high position of being the king, the very first king of Israel. Verse 14, and Saul's uncle said unto him and to his servants, whither went ye? Now, we don't know whether Saul's uncle met him at the high place or whether he waited till he got home before this meeting of the uncle occurred. But the uncle asked him where they went. He's trying to find out what did happen. And now we're going to see that Saul keeps this fact about his being nominated to be king secret. He does not let that word out. However, since the servant was with him, he does tell the uncle the things that the servant knew about. So he says, "Whither went ye?" And he said, "To seek the asses. And when we saw that they were nowhere, we came to Samuel." So he does relate the fact that they did go to Samuel to get information about the asses, although he says nothing about the kingship. And Saul's uncle said, "Tell me, I pray thee, what Samuel said unto you." So he wanted to know not only where they went, but what Samuel said. And Saul said unto his uncle, "He told us plainly that the asses were found." So he does tell the uncle all the things that the servant knew, all the things that the uncle could find out from the servant without even asking Saul. But of the matter of the kingdom, whereof Samuel spake, he told him not. So here Saul kept this matter about the kingdom, about him being nominated to be the king, or anointed to be the king, he kept this a secret. He didn't speak anything about this. And this may be for several reasons. It could demonstrate the humility of Saul, the fact that he didn't want to brag and vaunt himself up before his fellows at this time. It could be also that he knew that if he did bring this matter up, that it would bring a lot of publicity upon him, maybe a lot of other questions that would be more difficult to answer. It would cause quite a commotion and a stir, and he didn't want to be involved in that at this time. It might have caused a lot of undue envy. A lot of persons who might have had some desire to have been king couldn't understand why they chose this man Saul over them, and it would have been a conflicting situation. And he also might have kept this a secret simply due to his dependence upon God. He leaves it up to God to carry on this work through the prophet Samuel. Up to this time, Saul really had nothing to do with it. It wasn't his idea. It was a complete surprise to him. And so he can see that it'll be just as advantageous for him to sit still and let the matter fall as it will with God working through Samuel. So with Saul remaining silent on this matter, we see beginning in verse 17 where Samuel made the matter public. He made Saul's nomination to the throne of the kingdom a public matter by calling a general assembly of the people together at Mizpah. Now no doubt this was predominantly an invitation to the elders. They would have been the ones most interested and also most involved in this change of the government. And so now it becomes a public matter through Samuel. "And said unto the children of Israel, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I have brought up Israel out of Egypt, and delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of all kingdoms, and of them that oppressed you." So the first thing that Samuel does is he reminds the people of what a good government they had under God, how much benefit they had, and of the things that God had done for them. He had brought them up out of Egypt. Now they were a nothing while in Egypt. They were not even a nation in Egypt, but he had taken them as a child that had been cast aside from its mother without even any swaddling clothes on it. One that was thrown out into the desert with no way to survive. He'd taken them as a child like that, and he had nurtured them and formed them and made a nation out of them and brought them up out of Egypt. And he says, "I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all kingdoms and of them that had oppressed you." What more could they ask in a king and a leader? To be delivered out of the hand of all that oppressed them, out of the hand of all kingdoms. Not only just the delivery out of Egypt, which was most important, which had to occur for them to even exist as a nation, but he delivered them out of all the hands of the other persons or nations or groups that had oppressed them. Verse 19, "And ye have this day rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversities and your tribulations." So, this day, and what he means by that is upon this this occasion of demanding and requesting a king, you have rejected your God, the one who has led you and guided you and saved you, the one who's delivered you out of your adversities and your tribulations, whatever those might be, whether it be war, famine, lack of material goods, needing land to possess, a place to live, whatever. God had delivered them, he'd saved them, He had given them the things that they needed and wanted. And this is the same God now that you're rejecting. You have this day rejected your God. And the way that they rejected him was, and ye have said unto him, nay, but set a king over us. We want a king. We want a change in government. We want a change in the way that you've done things up to now, God. We're not pleased with this. We're not satisfied with this. This is not good enough for us. We want to change things up and be like the nations round about us. Now, God definitely tells them that this is a rejection of him. And, of course, any time we decide that we want something other than what God has given us, we want to make a change. We want to make a modification. We want to modernize. We want to become like those round about us rather than remain the way God would have us to be. Then this constitutes a rejection of God. And it will very definitely be interpreted that way, and we're going to have to bear the consequences of it in that same vein. Now, this rejection of God by demanding a king is also symbolic and possibly a type of the Jews later when they rejected Christ. They rejected him as being their king. They rejected him as being the one that was going to be their savior. And they made the flat statement that Caesar is our king. And of course we know by rejecting Christ, which was the thing and the person that God wanted them to be governed by in the church, they then were rejecting God. So anytime we reject the things of God, whatever they may be, whatever God has outlined for us to have and to follow, then we are rejecting God himself. And we must be most cautious that we not be found in that position of rejecting God. That's a very unfavorable position for anyone to be found in, and there will be consequences very dire as a result of it. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is NC Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.